This is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. On this segment of the program, we're going to be talking about cigarette addiction. We're going to be talking about a federal Justice Department lawsuit against the tobacco industry. This is captured to a very significant degree in a very new book that's actually supposed to come out this Monday, which is June 11th. It's entitled Bad Acts, the Racketeering Case Against the Tobacco Industry. It's published by the American Public Health Association. My guests are Sharon Eubanks, former U.S. Justice Department attorney. She's now a private attorney in Washington, D.C. My other guest is Professor Stanton Glantz, who was a guest on this program, gosh knows, at least 20 years ago. And Stan, by the way, this is wonderful. He bicycled up here to KALW, which has some...
Yeah, the main word there is
had some, had some hills here, and I asked him when he came down the hallway, I said, Stan, should I contact UCSF and get an ambulance for you? But he didn't need one. He is in the University of California, San Francisco Department of Medicine. He's the director of the Center for Tobacco Control Research and Education at UCSF, and both guests are authors of this new book, and we'll talk more about it. Funding for Your Legal Rights is made possible by the Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association of San Francisco, by the San Mateo County Bar Association, by the Board of Legal Specialization of the State Bar of California, and by the Family Law Section of the State Bar. You know, Sharon, it is nice to have you from Washington, D.C., and I hope you can hear me okay.
I can, and it's great to be here.
It's very nice to have you here. Would you do this? Because I think it's very important that the audience, all of us, get a chance to hear a little bit about the case that you brought going back to 1999. And from what you have told me as we were preparing for the program, the case still exists. Would you give us a capsule account of this case and why you got into it?
I'll try to do that as quickly and directly as I can. We filed this suit in 1999 after President Clinton announced in the State of the Union address that he was going to ask the Justice Department to look into the possibility of filing a suit against the industry in order to recoup the cost that the federal government had incurred in treating sick smokers. The case was a massive fraud case that spanned 50 years in time and had several basic elements. It was about the harms of the industry denying the harms of smoking and secondhand smoke, denying that it caused disease, that they denied that they marketed to youth, that when in fact they did market to youth. Their addictiveness of cigarettes and making the cigarettes more addictive was something that the companies were doing and hiding the evidence of that. They destroyed documents in the process of everything that they were doing. That was another large part of the case where they tried to cover up their fraudulent activities. They manipulated nicotine to make the product more deadly and more addictive. All of these parts were the fraud, the different areas of fraud that we alleged that the company had engaged in 5 years for one purpose and one purpose only, the profit motive. They did it to make money. So here was a product that, when used as directed, kills people. They made it more deadly, committed fraud, didn't let the public know, and continued to market the cigarettes and say, it's okay, light cigarettes and low-tar cigarettes, those are better for you, another one of the frauds that they committed, because they are not. So you asked me why I got into the case. I got into the case not for any, you know, unusual reason, but kind of the usual reason. Somebody who's at the Justice Department might decide to move around. I saw it as a challenge. I saw it as something different. At the time, I knew very little about the industry's activities and was just making a career move into something different. I wasn't trying to make a statement or anything like that. But within a few weeks of working on the case, I became convinced that the government had a strong case, mm-hmm. that it was an important issue for the American people, and then I was very, very pleased to be a part of it. So a lot like the smokers you read about, I got hooked.
Let me ask you this. So this case became your addiction, right?
Well, you know, you might say that, because for all of those years from I started working on the team on April 15th, 1999, and I walked out of the door of the Justice Department after 22 years of service with the Justice Department on December 1st, 2005. And most of the days that the nine-month trial went on, I worked. Every day. I didn't miss a moment of the trial.
No kidding. Oh, wow. Let me ask you this. The Speaker of the House is a smoker. The president smokes, the current president, Obama.
He quit.
Oh, the president quit? Did he?
Yes, you missed that?
I did miss it. Okay, so he quit. I'm glad to hear that. But the Speaker of the House, Mr. Boehner, still smokes, does he not?
I believe he does, Stan, doesn't he?
Yeah, I think so. The more important thing, though, rather not that he smokes, but he still takes loads of money from the cigarette.
That's not good.
There are people who smoke who, do very good things in terms of public health. There are public officials who appreciate their addiction and use their power to fight the tobacco industry. And then there's ones who take their money and do their bidding.
Now, we don't know. Today being Wednesday, June 6th, we don't know what the results will be of Prop 29, which part of it was to increase the tax on cigarette packs $1. We don't know whether that's going to pass or not at this point. But Sharon, let me ask you this. With respect to this case that you were dealing with from 1999 until you walked out of the Department of Justice on December 1st, 2005, what were you able to accomplish with this case? Because my understanding from what you've told me is that the case still is going on to some degree.
Yes, the case is still going on, and that's not unusual in civil litigation with powerful and large opponents on both sides of the V. What we accomplished in the case was the massive decision of the case, which was over 1,700 pages, laid out in specific and excruciating, in some ways, detail, the fraud that the industry had committed over time. It had citation to authority. So no longer was the industry in a position to say, oh, no, we didn't do that. We had an independent fact finder, a federal judge who was, this was a bench trial, not a jury trial, make specific factual findings after a nine-month trial on a full evidentiary record that demonstrated unequivocally that the industry had actually engaged in these heinous acts. That is something that cannot be undone. You can't unring that bell.
What, if I may interrupt you for a moment, mm-hmm. which federal agency investigated this case?
Well, that's an interesting question, Chuck, because this was a civil case. I suppose it's fair to say that the Department of Justice, along with the Federal Bureau of Investigation, mm-hmm. which is part of the Department of Justice, investigated this case for purposes of determining whether to bring a criminal action against the industry.
Mm-hmm.
And on the same day that we filed a suit, September 22nd, 1999, the criminal division of the Justice Department announced that it wouldn't file a criminal prosecution. So then it was up to the civil side to conduct its own investigation through the civil discovery process.
And by the civil discovery process, that means you no longer had the help of the FBI?
I had three FBI agents who were on my team until 9/11, understandably.
Oh, really? Oh, yeah.
But none of the FBI agents who were on the criminal side participated because of Rule 6E of the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure. We weren't permitted to take advantage of information that was gathered in a grand jury proceeding to bring it over to our side of the case without an order of the court. So ordinarily, we couldn't do that. So we had to start over.
Were you unhappy when the Department of Justice on the criminal side decided not to proceed with a criminal case against these some companies in the tobacco industry?
Only in retrospect, looking back at the case, knowing now what I know. At the time, I mean, I'm not a criminal practitioner. All of my practice, all of my career has been civil in nature. The standards are different, as you know, for proving or demonstrating a criminal case. So in looking back, I guess I found it difficult to understand why this wasn't a criminal RICO case, a racketeering case, but I didn't have any feeling at the time or disappointment that it didn't go forward. And in fact, if it had gone forward as a criminal case, any civil case would have been stayed pending resolution of a criminal matter.
You told me before we went on the air that the case still goes on. What's going on with the case right now?
Okay, here's what's going on with the case right now. It's back with the judge, Judge Gladys Kessler, who's taken senior status now, who made the findings, the 1,700 pages of findings, and presided over the nine-month trial and all of the discovery in the case. But here's how it got there. We filed our case. There were motions to dismiss. The claim, a couple of the statutory claims were dismissed, and the racketeering case remained. That's what we had at the end of the day.
Why did it fall within the terms of racketeering?
Because they were racketeers, because they had engaged in actions for the profit of their company that were unlawful, because they met the terms of the racketeering statute in terms of the predicate acts that that describe what is racketeering, because they lied to the public, because the public relied upon it, because fraud was committed, for all of those reasons. But to get back to your answer of how come we're still here...
And if I could just add, and not that I'm a lawyer, but I have read the 1,700-page decision, which is an amazing, amazing document. It's a historical document. It's because the companies colluded. They not only defrauded the public, but my understanding that they worked together.
They got together. It was a nice conspiracy, huh?
Exactly. Exactly, Stan. Mm. But the case went from the district court judge to the Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. It actually had a couple of trips to the D.C. Circuit. There was an interlocutory appeal on a really critical issue dealing with remedies and disgorgement of proceeds. But when the case was completed at the trial level and the decision was rendered in August of 2006, the case ultimately went up to the D.C. Circuit. And in 2009, the D.C. Circuit affirmed the decision of Judge Gladys Kessler. Both sides, both the United States and Philip Morris and the other companies, all of the defendants, sought certiorari before the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court denied cert. The basis for seeking cert is that there was a difference in the remedies allowed under the RICO statute if you filed in the Southern District of New York versus if you filed in Washington, D.C., a classic case of setting things up for purposes of cert, a split in the circuit on a critical legal issue on a major statute. Well, for whatever reason, they don't have to tell us why, the Supreme Court denied cert. When the Supreme Court denied cert, there was a brief period of time. Probably, I don't know what the time period is. I'm not a Supreme Court practitioner. But after a short period of time following that, the case went back to Judge Kessler for the to put the remedies in place. By the time that happened, in 2009, wasn't it, Stan? The Family Smoking and Prevention and Control Act?
I think it would be useful to just tell people what the remedies were that she put in place before we get off into the...
What were the remedies? There wasn't any real cash involved in this, was there, or was there?
There was very little cash involved. Why is that? Yeah, I'm sorry?
There was very little cash? Because there was you initially wanted to have the tobacco companies disgorge their profits because of the alleged fraud that you had put into your action. Why is it that there was no cash finally ending up that the tobacco companies had to pay?
Because the only monetary part of the case that we were pursuing was the disgorgement of proceeds, which during the pendency of the case went up to the D.C. Circuit, and the D.C. Circuit said that disgorgement was not an appropriate remedy under the RICO statute, because under the RICO statute you look forward to whether the unlawful acts are continuing into the future or likely to continue into the future. And that disgorgement was, the D.C. Circuit pointed out, in their view, quintessentially backward-looking. Now, the second circuit had held differently and said that disgorgement was an appropriate remedy, but we weren't in the Second Circuit. So that money was off the table. So the remedies that ended up coming into play involved things like, you know, not being able to have lights and mild cigarettes. There were, we had several pages of remedies that the judge went through over time, saying product placement. There were some issues that were raised as to whether the First Amendment would allow that. Corrective statements. The companies were all required to make corrective statements on certain television programs about the fact that they had lied about these things for a long period.
Did they ever do it?
I haven't seen any corrective statements yet. I don't know what that's tied up with.
The Department of Justice did propose, I mean, the court ruled in the appellate process supported that the companies should be ordered to make corrective statements to point out that they had lied, that they knew nicotine was addictive, that light and mild cigarettes weren't any safer. The Department of Justice proposed what I thought were very reasonable set of statements that the companies would have had to have published in newspapers, run in advertisements in the electronic media, where, in which it said they admitted that they had lied. The companies objected to that on First Amendment grounds, which I found, frankly, bizarre, but they did. And that's gone up on appeal.
So it's up on appeal right now?
Yeah, the corrective statements are up on appeal
but
right now.
But the corrective statements, Stan, are up on appeal in a separate case that came out of the FDA through a different judge on the D.C.
That's the Food and Drug Administration, right?
Right, so it's slightly different. That issue is now, but it's exactly the same issue, but there have been some parallels since the FDA got jurisdiction to regulate the product.
Well, no, I think, are you talking about the warning labels?
The
warning labels and the corrective statements are two different things.
No, they're
totally different. The companies are trying to confuse them. But my understanding, and maybe I'm wrong, but my understanding is that the Department of Justice filed a set of corrective statements. The companies said that the judge overreached in approving them, and that's gone
that
up,
went
on
up
appeal.
On appeal.
That's separate.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, the Family Smoking Prevention Tobacco Control Act required putting graphical warning labels on cigarette packages, included that said, you know, smoking causes cancer
Do we have that now? Is that being done?
Well, that's in the law, but the tobacco companies also appealed that. In both cases, they argued it was a violation of their First Amendment rights by compelling them to say things they didn't want to say. I mean, I think both of those arguments are sort of fallacious because, you know, here we have an industry that was convicted of committing a massive fraud and covering it up, and the judge has said you have to publish statements admitting that, and the companies are saying, well, that's violating our First Amendment rights because it's compelled speech. Well, I mean, if you have some people who broke the law by lying, and then when you say you have to admit that, they're saying, well, it's against the First Amendment to make us admit that we lied.
Yeah, they're relying on the commercial speech doctrine, which I'm not particularly schooled in.
Yeah.
But it is something that's not unusual for them to make those claims. I guess I need to look back and see where the case is, because I'm a little bit surprised to hear that there's an appellate piece of the case going on right now, because again, that would be interlocutory, which is highly unusual.
Let me come back to this for a moment. The book that both of you have worked on now. How long have you both been working on putting together this book, which I understand is supposed to come out, supposed to be available as of June 11th, just a few days from now? How long have you both been working together on this?
It seems like all my life, but I think Stan should tell the story of how this happened.
I don't remember exactly.
My gosh.
But what happened was Sharon was out at UCSF giving a seminar about the case, and to a rapt audience, and at the end, several of them said, this is such a great story, you ought to write a book about it. And as I was taking her back to my house to just hang out before I took her to her hotel, I was saying, you know, they're right, you really ought to write a book. And Sharon said, I've never written a book, I'm a lawyer, not an author. And I said, hey, you wrote these like thousands of pages of legal briefs, you should write a book, and you've got to do it. And so I sat her down at my dining room table and wouldn't take her back to her hotel. So she wrote out the table. I said, well, just tell me what happened and what happened and what happened. And then we had the table of contents. And I actually thought that was kind of where I helped find get the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, gave Sharon a little money, for her to write the book, because at that point she was unemployed, having been forced to retire early from the Justice Department as a reward for winning the case. And then she sort of, my main role initially was nagging.
Yes, it was.
And finally she produced a book that read like a legal brief. And it had a lot of Latin in it, and certain lawyers made certain statements that were of interest. And so I started working with her to translate it into English.
So us human beings could read it?
Yeah, and managed to present a very good story and a quite engaging political story in a way which was completely boring and abstract. And so I ended up spending a lot of time like editing and rewriting and helping her, and as time went on, I thought, Jesus, I didn't think I was going to spend this much time on this. I ought to be a co-author. Yeah.
No,
and then about a day or two later...
I told you.
No, I hadn't told you that. I was just thinking it. And then a day or two later, Sharon calls me up and says, I think you ought to be a co-author. But the best thing about this book, and I've written several books on a variety of topics, and this is the only one my wife actually read and enjoyed.
No kidding.
And she said it was a real page-turner.
Well, this is wonderful.
But I think that's because Sharon was the main author.
All right. The title of this new book is Bad Acts, The Racketeering Case Against the Tobacco Industry. It's published by the American Public Health Association. What is that, Sharon?
What is the American Public Health Association?
Yes.
My savior. I tried to get this book published. I wrote it, as Stan pointed out, Robert Wood Johnson had given me a grant, because I sort of have this thing, and it's sort of a theme in the book. If you didn't write it down, it never happened.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to write it all down and make a record of it. And then after I wrote it all down and made a record of it, I wanted people to read about it. I wanted them to know. Well, there were public health interveners in the case, six organizations that came in after, towards the end of the case, when the Bush administration forced us to reduce the remedy that we were seeking for cost of treating smokers through smoking cessation programs. After that happened...
If I could just interrupt you. What happened was... I think one of the really big mistakes Sharon made... was because I think that when the Bushies came in, they tried to kill the case, and the public health people stopped that. And then I think that the Bush people sort of ignored the case, figuring that nobody could beat a cigarette company, and kind of left them alone. And Sharon and her team did their thing and made progress. And then Sharon made a huge mistake of saying to the Bush people, "I think we're going to win."
Yeah, that's true. I think that I don't remember what chapter there is.
Yeah, there is a chapter called Gentlemen, I Think We're Winning This Case.
That's it.
And that's when the boom got lowered. And after the department had put in evidence, the evidence to have the tobacco companies pay for a large smoking
cessation. We're talking about millions and millions, aren't we?
Billions.
Billions, okay.
Yeah, as a forward-looking remedy. After the evidence was in the case, the Bush people came in and forced Sharon to actually make a closing statement that disagreed with the evidentiary base she and her team had built.
What did they do? Threaten to fire you if you didn't do that, Sharon, or what?
No, they didn't have to threaten me. They didn't have to threaten to fire me. They came to our planning sessions for doing the closing arguments, and I got a call from the number two person in the department, who's a political appointee, Robert McCallum, and he said, "I want to talk to you about lowering the remedy for the smoking cessation, getting it down to $10 or $12 billion. At the end of the day, those are the people, the political appointees are the people who make the policies, who say what's what.
Yeah.
I knew if I went into that courtroom and didn't read their closing argument, which I made them write, because I refused to. I said it's not logical. The evidence doesn't support it. I can't do that. You have to show me how. So I made them write it. And when they wrote it, I read it to the court. I didn't argue it. I read it to the court. Because had I not, it wouldn't have stopped anything.
Mm-hmm.
They would have still, if I had gone in and argued something contrary to that, They could have filed papers withdrawing it. Mm-hmm. They got the final say. And my guidance at the time from the ethical rules and the things that I checked that guided me, the ethical rules and professors, told me that, you know, it was going to end up this way anyway. And I could be fired for insubordination if I didn't follow through.
Yeah.
And I wanted to see the case through to get the findings of fact, the proposed findings out after the trial before I walked out the door. I didn't want to leave it until I was completely done with it.
And so what happened, this was such a bizarre turn of events. And I was actually in a meeting of the American Cancer Society, Heart Association, Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids, Lung Association, and others talking about it, because this was front page news. This dramatic reversal of what the government was saying was just downright bizarre.
We're talking about what, 2006 was front page news, or 2005, what?
It was actually front page news in 2005, and then again it hit the papers, I guess, a couple of years later, mm-hmm. after President Bush fired the U.S. attorneys.
Yeah, but at the time it was 2005, and there was a meeting of the public health groups to say, this is outrageous. Yeah, what can we do? And what we decided, it was an extreme long shot, but to go and file papers with the court asking to be granted intervener status in a case that was almost completed, and for the purpose of arguing the remedy, since the government was not acting in the public interest.
And it was one of the saddest days of my professional life when the judge issued an order that said that because the Justice Department has failed to represent the public interest, I'm allowing these health groups, these public health groups, to intervene so that they can urge an appropriate remedy in their view, because basically your Justice Department isn't going to do that.
We are coming to the end of the statewide version of the program, which we distribute, of course, throughout California on other public radio stations as well as some commercial stations. For those of you who are listening to us live, whether it's in the Bay Area or on www.kow.org, we will continue for another half hour. It is about 7:28 at 91.7, your local public radio station, KLW in San Francisco. You know, as I so frequently say with many of the topics that we do on this program, too bad this is only an hour show, because obviously with what both of you have to talk about, we haven't even gotten into the thought of cigarette addiction or whatever to any significant degree. But let me tell you, if I may, who my guests are. And they are a couple of very significant people. Professor Stan Glantz is at the UCSF, that's the University of California, San Francisco Department of Medicine. He's the director of the Center for Tobacco Control Research and Education at UCSF. My other guest is Sharon Eubanks. She was with the Federal Department of Justice for about 22 years. She's now a private attorney in Washington, D.C. They both are the authors of a new book, which will be coming out in a few days, called Bad Acts, ACTS: The Racketeering Case Against the Tobacco Industry. It's published by the American Public Health Association. And it's a fascinating story. I think there's a lot of disappointment here in terms of the fact that Sharon was not backed by the Bush administration. She apparently was not even backed enough by the Clinton administration when she started this. And, of course, what we have here is a situation where the case still goes on, where there have been no major changes, major admittings, apparently, by the tobacco industry of misrepresentations to the public. And at this point, we don't even know if our own state, Prop 29, what the result is as of this date anyway, which happens to be Wednesday, June 6th. I want to give you an opportunity to call in with your questions, your comments, if you would like. It's 1-415-841-4134, 1-415-841-4134. This is Your Legal Rights. I'm Chuck Finney. And we are talking about cigarette addiction. I'd like to talk about it to some degree. And a federal Justice Department lawsuit that Sharon Eubanks started in 1999, believe it or not. and it continues, parts of it continue even today. So for those of you who are so inclined, if you would like, join us. I think one of the things that has gotten me about this book is the fact that, as you put it, Sharon, and also you, Stan, put it, there was an agreement, whether we want to call it a conspiracy, between members of the tobacco industry to really go out to try to addict children or teenagers in smoking. Stan, would you talk a little bit about this?
Well, I think, and Sharon, you can correct me if I'm wrong, it was a conspiracy.
It was. It definitely was. We don't have to, hold on that.
We don't have to sugarcoat it,
huh? And that's one of the things that the court found, is that there was a conspiracy. That's what made it racketeering. And that the companies went out and systematically did marketing research and product development so they could sell their products to children, get them addicted so they would continue smoking into adulthood, and so the companies could make a lot of money. And as people became concerned about the health effects of smoking, the companies developed the ideas of light and mild cigarettes and marketed them in a way that people thought meant they were safer when they weren't, and that the court ordered them to stop doing that. There have been a couple of aspects of the court order, by the way, which have gone into effect. The companies have been prohibited from joint action and funding research. That was another important element of the conspiracy, and that has really broken up a lot of the activities of the companies for the active manipulation of science, which was important. Mm-hmm. The companies have been ordered to continue to make public internal documents related to smoking and health issues through 2025, I believe, and those documents make their way to UCSF, and we have a website called legacy.library.ucsf.edu.
Wait a minute, let's get this again.
Legacy,
it's called Legacy.
Legacy.library.ucsf.edu. And we have about 80 million pages of industry internal correspondence. And
they are accessible through
everyone,
this website?
Yes, they're accessible to anyone in the world. And,
fantastic.
You know, during the Prop 29 debate, the California Taxpayers Association, the Hispanic Chamber of Commerce, FreedomWorks, Americans for Prosperity, were all out there claiming to just be independent voices opposing the tobacco tax. And if you go into the legacy documents, you find that these organizations had longstanding financial ties with the tobacco industry and acted in a conspiratorial way as what the industry called third parties, to allow the tobacco companies to manipulate public debate over issues, in this case the tobacco tax, while the companies themselves stayed out of the public eye. We know that because these documents were produced in part because of the DOJ settlement, and in fact, just right before the New Year's, the Department of Justice got the court to enter into an order requiring the companies to produce the documents in a way which made it easier for us to make them available for free to the world, and also ordered the companies to pay the court $6.9 million, which the court then is turning around and giving to UCSF to continue making these documents available.
That's very interesting.
To the public and to improve their searchability and things like that.
Let me give you the website again in case you're interested in looking at this, legacy.library.ucsf.edu. Again, the book that we're talking about that has the background, a fascinating background about this case that started in 1999 is Bad Acts, the Racketeering Case Against the Tobacco Industry. I think it's a significant book that both of my guests have put together really to educate you in many areas, not only how our government works or how it doesn't work or what's important, etc., but I think it's important in case you are interested in this. Before we take our first call, let me just mention this. A seminar is being presented by the Lawyer Referral and Information Service of the Bar Association of San Francisco, which is one of the funders of this program. And this seminar is on small business and understanding your Americans with Disability Act requirements. We did a program on this a few months ago, and so the Lawyer Referral Service is sponsoring this. It's going to, in case you're interested and you have a small business, it's on Tuesday, June 19th. It'll be from about 8:15, that's registration, until, actually it's a short program, until 10 a.m. at the San Francisco Chamber Boardroom, Chamber of Commerce Boardroom on Montgomery Street. And if you're interested in this, let me give you a phone number to call. It's 415-352-8803, 415-352-8803, for this seminar on small business, understanding your ADA requirements. And there's a small fee. I think it's only $25. Actually, they even serve breakfast, believe it or not. All right, so this is Your Legal Rights, the number 1415-841-4134. And Reed, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hi.
I'd like to ask a question of Dr. Glantz. I understand that, and perhaps I'm mistaken in this, but I understand that he was one of the first, or a pioneer in establishing the physiological aspects of nicotine addiction. And I wondered if he would go into that aspect of it to the extent that he can in this format. And I would also like to ask him what he thinks of the idea that we choose our addictions.
Well, actually, addiction is not one of the areas I'm expert in. You're probably mixing me up with Neil Benowitz, who's another UCSF professor of medicine who is one of the world authorities on addiction and, in fact, was a witness in Sharon's case. The thing I can tell you is that the reason nicotine, this is based on what Neil and others have shown, that nicotine actually mimics the chemicals by which nerve cells communicate and changes the actual physical chemistry of the brain in ways that when you take the nicotine away, the brain isn't functioning normally.
It's not, yeah.
And, I mean, basically what nicotine does, by simulating normal neurotransmitter chemicals, the chemicals that nerve cells communicate with, it sort of turns the brain up too loud. And so what happens is your brain adapts by kind of putting earmuffs on so it doesn't hear so many of these neurotransmitters. And then when you take the nicotine away, the brain is kind of out of whack.
Really?
And so the
for
the
a while, not permanent.
Well, these changes are actually permanent.
Really?
But what happens, the relaxation smokers feel is actually treatment of nicotine withdrawal. Now, after you've quit over a period of a few weeks, what they're called receptor sites downregulate, and you kind of get used to having normal levels of these neurotransmitter chemicals around. But the changes don't go away, and that's why someone can go years and years and years without a cigarette and then smoke a cigarette or two and go right back to being a regular smoker. It kind of wakes the system
incredible.
Up.
Incredible. Incredible.
But I'm an expert on secondhand smoke, but not. But Neil is the nicotine guy.
Okay. With regard to secondhand smoke, there was a number of years ago a judgment in North Carolina, which disputed the validity of that theory. Whatever happened to that?
The Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit reversed it.
Which means what, Sharon? Reversed what? What was
it? They reversed the decision. There was a finding by the lower court that the Environmental Protection Agency didn't have authority to put out a report that it did on secondhand smoke, which stated that it was a human carcinogen. And the question was whether EPA had operated outside its authority. The lower court in North Carolina found that it had. However, on appeal to the Fourth Circuit, the Fourth Circuit reversed that determination and stated that the EPA did have authority to issue its risk assessment about what was called ETS, environmental tobacco smoke or secondhand smoke, and that that decision of the lower court in North Carolina was reversed.
The other thing, well, I don't want to get off into a whole discussion of secondhand smoke, but another important thing, and Sharon mentioned it, is this: the court in North Carolina wasn't ruling on the science. They didn't say the EPA was wrong in saying secondhand smoke caused cancer. They were ruling on a procedural question of whether the EPA had a right to do the study in the first place.
The EPA exactly. being the Environmental Protection Agency.
Yeah. You know, that whole interchange was actually, and the issues around the industry's misrepresentation of the risks of secondhand smoke was another element of the fraud in the RICO case.
So in terms of, Stan, your experience, which is extensive, is there validity to the concern that many of us have about secondhand smoke?
Oh, yeah. It causes lung cancer. It causes breast cancer. It causes heart disease.
Crib death.
Crib death, yeah, sudden infant death, asthma attacks. We've done studies at UCSF where we've shown that a half an hour of exposure at about the level people used to have in bars was enough to basically shut down normal functioning of your blood vessels in ways that increase the risk of a heart attack.
Wow. Incredible. Well, Reed, thank you for your questions. You've opened up the door here, and I thank you for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Okay, take care now. This is Your Legal Rights, the number 1415-841-4134. 1415-841-4134. And for those of you who are wondering, when is the next Call a Lawyer night? It'll be at the end of this month, the last Wednesday of the month, June 27th, I think it will be. And on the program, on the air, we will have landlord-tenant law with Coy Driscoll and Mark Seidenfeld, the two guys who are so good at landlord-tenant. And then we will have a number of attorneys here in the conference room who will be ready, willing, and able to talk with you off the air on our 800 number, 1-800-525-9917. And by the way, I want you to know that you can get a copy of this or any of the Your Legal Rights programs, as we do them, at least the current programs, at www.kalw.org/RRS. I think I got that right. Let me make sure if I did. Yes, www.kalw.org/RRS. And we're also archived on the KLW website if you want to look for any of the programs since the beginning of the year, as I understand it. In any event, I want you to know who my guests are. Sharon Eubank, she's a former U.S. Justice Department attorney. She was there for 22 years. She handled this case we're talking about from April of 1999 until December 1st of 2005, when her department so graciously said, "You better leave before we kick you out the door," which she kind of told me off the air. My other guest is Professor Stan Glantz, UCSF Department of Medicine and Director of the Center for Tobacco Control Research and Education at UCSF. By the way, you all are very quiet tonight. I don't know why that is. Whether or not we have too many of you smoking and you do not wish to call, or maybe you're so rabid about non-smoking you don't wish to call, but it would be nice to hear from you. 1-415-841-4134. And let me just do this before we take another call. If you have a legal problem, you may need to talk to a lawyer. The Bar Association of San Francisco's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange an appointment for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. This is a public service of the Bar Association of San Francisco, and for a referral to a lawyer, call 415-989-1616. That's 415-989-1616. This information is brought to you by the Bar Association of San Francisco and KLW listeners like you. If you're in San Mateo County, the San Mateo County Bar Association also has a lawyer referral service. You can call your own during normal business hours at 650-369-4149. 650-369-4149. If you're in any other county in California, every county in California has a bar association and lawyer referral service. Call your own. They'll do their best. Call your own during normal business hours. They'll do their best to find someone experienced for you with respect to the problem that you're having. They'll set you up for a half an hour consultation with a lawyer. Depending on the county, for a half an hour, you'll pay perhaps a low of $25, maybe a high of $35. It's a great way to kind of get some basic information about the problem that you're dealing with. So let's see if we can get some of you to call in and ask some questions, etc. What I want to do is, you talked about, Stan, you talked about off-the-air color-coded packs. What do you mean by that, and what's the significance of that?
Well, one of the things that Judge Kessler found was that the tobacco companies, by marketing so-called light cigarettes and mild cigarettes, defrauded the public because health-concerned smokers thought by smoking these light and mild cigarettes, they were actually smoking less risky cigarettes and less dangerous to their health. And Judge Kessler found that was fraudulent, that the companies knew that these cigarettes weren't any less dangerous, but yet marketed them that way and ordered them to stop. And it wasn't just using the words, but communicating that idea. Also, when Congress passed the bill that gave the FDA authority over cigarettes, they also banned the light and mild monikers. What the tobacco companies did was simply color-coded the packs. They took the words off, but full flavor became red. Light became gold. Mild became silver. I may be mixing up the colors.
Okay.
But then the companies actually gave convenience stores a little decoder sheet that said if somebody comes in asking for regulars, give them the red pack. If they're asking for ultralights, give them the blue pack. And in my view, and having read Judge Kessler's decision and having read the Family Smoking and Prevention Act, this is simply a clear violation of what the court ordered them to do and a clear violation of the FDA law. And yet I'm very disappointed that neither the Obama administration Department of Justice nor the Obama Food and Drug Administration has initiated any kind of enforcement action against the companies. I think the Department of Justice should be dragging them back before Judge Kessler and saying, Your Honor, you ordered them to stop communicating these fraudulent information. Mm-hmm. They're still doing it. They're just doing it with colors instead of words. And the same with the Department of or the Food and Drug Administration. And we just haven't seen any action out of Obama. And the one thing I've learned in working on tobacco forever is that everything is political, and these decisions are not being made by the worker bees at the bottom. They're being made, just as some of the things Sharon was telling you about, by the political people and by the White House.
Are you also, both of you, saying that the tobacco companies do a lot of funding of various political campaigns, et cetera?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they do.
Yeah. Well, there we are. Money is the root of all evil, is it not?
Well, you know, President Obama has done some good things on health and tobacco, and I think that frankly they're afraid of the controversy that the tobacco companies would whip up before the election if they did something.
Isn't it incredible?
And so they're kind of hiding. I mean, I think we clearly have two independent examples of the tobacco companies thumbing their nose at the law, and the law enforcement government, the executive, is just letting them get away with it.
Too bad.
And the result is people are using these products, they're being misled, and they're getting sick and dying as a result.
It's particularly disappointing when I think on a personal level that I took so much out of my life to litigate this case, because it is an important case, and the results were important to the American people. And then to just put it on the shelf when we have an order in place that would that requires the industry to undertake certain actions, and no one is saying, hey, wait, they're not doing it, make them. Because that's what an order is there for.
Yeah.
It's to be enforced, and not much more needs to be done. So that's kind of disappointing.
Well, Sharon, I certainly want to thank you for the efforts that you went to try to help the public of the United States, and it's a shame that the political system is such that what all the effort you put into this, and the same with you, Stan, really is not protecting the public as the public should be protected. Let's talk with Steve. Welcome to the program.
Hi there. Great program. Couple quick things. Would you guys address the portrayal of these suits in the popular films, like Thank You for Not Smoking, and these other ones? And then also, I used to work on asbestos cases, and it seems that a lot of those plaintiff attorneys, in fact, almost all of the big ones, all went on to the tobacco cases when that opened up, and that became a real big payday for a lot of plaintiff attorneys.
Well, let me get some comments for you, Steve. Thank you very much for calling. What comments do you have sharing about, like, Thank You for Not Smoking, for example? I never saw the movie. I remember when it came out, and I think it was pretty popular. What comments do you have, if any? And Stan?
Well, Stan's probably got some comments on the movies. If I could, I'd like to comment on the plaintiff's lawyers who left asbestos and then went to tobacco.
Please do.
As a federal government employee, we were salaried, and we didn't get any extra pay for pursuing the industry.
You didn't get any extra cigarettes?
No, we didn't get any bonuses, and I wouldn't have wanted to be paid in anything like cigarettes. In terms of the portrayal in the movies, I think that's something that Stan is more qualified to talk about than I am.
Well, there's sort of two different issues. One is the general issue of smoking in the movies, which I have a big campaign going on.
Humphrey Bogart was smoking in every movie.
Yeah, they got paid off for that.
Well, I'm sure they did.
But the specific movie, Thank You for Smoking...
Not smoking.
That's actually quite a good movie, and it's very well researched. And the thing that's amazing about it is a whole lot of the stuff in there, which is presented as kind of over-the-top satire. If you go into the industry documents, you'll see that they actually tried to do an awful lot of the stuff which is portrayed in that film. So I view it more as a sort of, rather than a comedy, I view it more as a documentary.
The guy who played the role in Thank You for Smoking actually was patterned after a woman, Brennan Dawson, who worked for the tobacco industry.
Uh-huh.
And she was a spokesperson for them. It's my understanding, Stan, that there isn't any smoking in that particular movie.
I don't think there is.
Yeah.
It's a pretty funny movie.
It is.
Well, let me get another call here. Anne, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hi.
Oh, I have a question. I read in a science magazine something that I've read it only once, and they're generally hypotheses, so I don't know if you all agree with it, but I read that there are certain genetic structures, like a gene is turned on in some people who become habitual smokers. And often the people who can smoke like once a month, but I just read it once, so I don't know.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, there are genetic factors that help determine how you're going to respond to smoking. I mean, there are some people who will smoke a cigarette or two or five and can stop very easily. There are other people who one cigarette and they're addicted. And I mentioned earlier, I talked about these receptors in your brain that are affected by nicotine, and there's not just one kind. There's a bunch of different kinds and different mixtures. And so, you know, people who have certain biology are more susceptible to nicotine addiction, which isn't surprising. I mean, everybody who smokes doesn't get lung cancer. Everybody who smokes doesn't get heart disease. And
George Burns smoked until nearly 100 years of age.
So, this is sort of a broader area that epidemiologists call gene-environment interaction. And so, you know, everybody who gets exposed to a flu virus doesn't get the flu. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there are genetic factors that are important in terms of the addictive potential of cigarettes, but they're really swamped out, and this gets back to the case, by the way cigarettes are designed. I mean, a lot of people think of a cigarette as some tobacco wrapped in paper, and they're not. They're a very, very high-tech product. There are all kinds of additives. There's control of the mixtures of the cigarette, the kind of paper, the porosity of the paper, the what's called ventilation holes, little microscopic holes that are put in the filter to control the mixture with room air, things to control burn rates. And the cigarettes are designed to deliver a metered dose of nicotine on a puff-by-puff basis. David Kessler, who had been the head of the Food and Drug Administration in the Clinton administration, actually was one of the witnesses in Sharon's case, and was the dean at UCSF for a while. I heard him give a talk, and he said that the nicotine delivery by a cigarette is more tightly controlled than most drugs that you buy in a drugstore.
Incredible. Would you say, Stan, that most smokers are addicted?
Yes.
You are? Okay. We have about 2 minutes left of the program, unfortunately. It's been a delight to have both of you on. Sharon, what concluding statements do you want to make?
Well, I think that anybody who wants to know about how their government works and doesn't work would be interested in reading the book. I mean, we take you through what happens from the inception of the case, the filing of it, the announcement by then-President Clinton, to the destruction of the case at the end with the Bush administration. And we go through the ups and downs of a mammoth piece of litigation that was related directly to public health. So, and I think that it was an honor and a privilege to work on the case. And it was hell working with Stan to write the book. But I'm that too.
He's a tough editor, is he?
Oh, yes.
And he kind of really ragged at you, huh?
Yeah, but I mean, it made it. The book wouldn't have been possible without Stan.
Well, that's good.
You know, I'm constantly thankful to him for making me do it, because it wouldn't have been otherwise written.
Stan, you got 30 seconds. What
well,
do you want
I
to say
think,
about this?
Think that, you know, it's a tremendously important case. The case is going on. And I think people need to pressure the Obama administration to aggressively implement the remedies in the case. And I think other politicians, our attorney general, who's been kind of missing in action on the tobacco issue.
You're talking about our California attorney general.
Kamala Harris,
yeah,
has been kind of useless.
Too bad.
They need to really be looking at this and seeing how to use it to keep the tobacco companies from continuing to defraud the public and kill people.
Well, I thank both of you very much for being on the program. It's been a delight to have you, Sharon, join us from Washington, D.C.
Thank you, Chuck. I've enjoyed every minute of it.
Well, thank you very much. And, Stan, nice to see you after 20 years. I guess in another 20 years, gosh, I don't know what we're going to be talking about. Okay, my guests have been Sharon Eubanks, former U.S. Justice Department attorney. She's now a private attorney in Washington, D.C., and Professor Stan Glantz of UCSF. They're the authors, co-authors of Bad Acts, the Racketeering Case Against the Tobacco Industry. It's APHA Press, and it comes out supposedly in a few days. I thank you both very much for being on the program. Your Legal Rights production staff members are program engineer Joanne Marb. Joanne, nice to have you back. And production assistant Martin McLean. Funding for Your Legal Rights is made possible by the Lawyer Referral Service of the Bar Association of San Francisco, by the Trusts and Estates Section of the State Bar, the Labor and Employment Law Section of the State Bar, the California Applicants Attorneys Association, and the San Mateo County Bar Association. Next week, if you are employed in a place where you've got a computer, or if you are an employer, we're going to be doing an employment law program on employees' rights on computers at work and employers' access to computers in the workplace. My guests are employment law attorneys Brian Schwartz and Jonathan Wong. I hope you join us then. Thanks very much for listening. I'm Chuck Finney.